Okay, good morning and welcome to ITE 2 Module 13 Part B. As we found last week and the week before, these last few modules of ITE 2 are quite long, so we've decided to split them into two parts. So we've been talking about the hardware and software configuring of Linux, and last week we finished with the emergency making emergency disks, and now I'm just about to continue on with the Linux installation disks. So one of obviously the first place you're going to look for installation disks or media that you're going to use when you're installing Linux is to use your Linux installation disk that come with your operating system and to install the operating system first. Sounds absolutely the correct mondo thing to do. So, okay, so most of your distributions of Linux are going to include an emergency boot disk system, and that can be accessed as an option when you're installing or loading the installation media. Just for example there, when you're starting, for example, to load Red Hat, there's a Linux rescue command, and it'd be typed at the LILO prompt, and if you're using a different distribution, you'd need to just have a look at the documentation that comes with your installation media. Now, the official name for emergency disk distribution is TOMSRTBT, which stands for Tom's Floppy, which has a root file system and it's a bootable disk. You can actually, this is old now, but we'll talk about it in case you need to know it for your exams. You can actually download.
Tom's root and boot disk is still around. Yeah, no, that one still exists. So that one's not crusty.
Still exists?
Yeah. No, that's still there.
Okay. But you can actually download it from the internet, and it fits onto one floppy disk. So, and it's a complete bootable Linux system, and it can be used from your command line. Not supported with a GUI. Okay, now, and just as a point, if you want the URL for that, it's the toms.net/rb, obviously www in front. Okay, also we need to talk about ZipSlack, and that's available for Slackware Linux. It can be installed on a small partition or on a removal drive like a zip disk, and it's 100 meg size, and the advantage of having a larger version of Linux is that what is available in a single floppy, it's easier to customise with your commercial backup tools and your custom kernel drivers.
I'd like to make a point, actually.
Yep.
These days, because these notes are a little bit dated, what we actually do, and you can do this with ZipSlack, that sort of does tie in here as well, a lot of people actually put their Linux bootable images onto flash drives. And if your BIOS can boot from a thumbstick, flash drive, whatever you want to call it, you can actually put your Linux distribution on there and get a whole all sorts of things on there.
And way to go.
Yeah, it just so happens you can actually get a 4 gig flash drive for $15 now. So get quite a lot of Linux on 4 gig so you can get ZipSlack on in 100 meg and still have space to stick all your files on.
Another emergency boot disk is DemoLinux. And it's larger than the 100 meg ZipSlack, and you could burn it onto a CD, CDR. And it's got a complete version of Linux, and it works, and it even allows the XGUI to run.
Ah, now there's another one, which isn't in these notes, which is worth a look. If you have an old 486 and you're wondering what to do with it, and you already do have things to keep your doors open with, there is a thing called DSL or Damn Small Linux, and it takes up 50 meg of disk space, and it has a complete graphical user interface and lets you surf the net and word process documents on a 66 megahertz 486 with 16 meg of RAM or better. So, there you go.
That sounds good. SUSE evaluation is another one, and similar to Demo Linux, about the same size, needs to be burned onto a CDR, and you can actually get a evaluation version of it from www.suse.com, S-U-S-E, that is, .com.
Okay. That URL still works, I'm going to check.
Yeah,
go for it. The Tom's one still works, by the way, toms.net/rb, that still exists, and there's a wiki, which is basically an excuse for open source people not to write documentation. You get the community to do it for you. Keep going, I'll have a look at suse.com.
That's okay, yeah, please check it. Yes, that'll be good. For the most part, the emergency boot disks that I've spoken about are going to be sufficient for most purposes, but you might want to have a customised emergency boot disks. For example, if the system that you're working on has got hardware that needs particular drivers or uses a particular file system, or any other configurations that you would not find normally supported, you could make a custom boot disks. When you're creating a custom emergency boot disk, the simplest and one recommended method for doing it is to make one that suits your individual needs and the needs of the computer that you're working on, and the best way to do it is to modify one of your existing boot disks. And you can actually modify that so that the features are going to be that you need are going to be added. ZipSlack boot disk is one of the better options to choose when you're creating a custom emergency boot disk. It acts in a similar way to your regular Linux, but it obviously lacks some of the features such as your GUI. Also allows you as the end user to recompile its kernel and to add any of the tools that you might require and to configure it in the way you would wish to. And another thing that makes it a good choice is that there's a space on it to make additions to the 100 meg zip disk, and you can actually add or remove programs that you're not going to need. Sorry?
We're just discussing here. We don't think you can even buy zip drives anymore. They came up with a new version of 250 meg, and then flash drives just basically wiped them out of the market. Just an interesting case in point. You can still find computers with zip drives in them, so you will still come across them, but they used to be sort of our technical colleges over here used to have them in all the labs because they seemed like a good idea at the time.
Anyway, you can customise them as much as you wish to, and you can make them as large or small as you need to as well. Okay, did you try that URL, Kerry?
Yes, SUSE is now owned by Novell, and it's now called Novell Enterprise Linux. And if I remember correctly, the cost of Novell Enterprise Linux is $75, so somewhat cheaper than Windows.
I'll say, yeah, and just a bit.
And highly functional, from what I've been told. Apparently, it's good, and it works really well. And it is actually a viable desktop replacement.
Excellent. Okay, so irrespective of which emergency boot disk or boot system that you're using, you have the ability, to have several different types of recovery tools, and you need to have those to make sure that you can repair when you need to, I'll say, not if you need to.
It's probably worth mentioning here that if you are looking at getting recovery tools and rescue disks and stuff, and this all sort of makes a bit of sense, but nobody ever thinks about it, why don't you get your recovery disks and stuff before your internet connection's gone down and your Linux machine is crashed, because building your recovery disk after your Linux machine is crashed is quite difficult when you can't get on the internet anymore.
Absolutely. Okay, so you need to have recovery tools that give you like all your latest drivers, your latest file systems, other options that you may wish, things like you might want to have the text editor such as VI included, so that you can actually look at your configuration files and edit them accordingly. And and VI is sort of one of the recommended ones because it's not a large program. Disk utilities, you should have the disk utilities such as FDisk, MKFS and FSCK, and they can be used to format a hard drive so that you can have Linux installed on it. And it's really important that you have all these utilities in place before you get problems. Okay, now your backup software, you need to also have a backup of your software that you have, and that's a very important issue as well. Most of the distributions that we've discussed come with a backup utility. You might have tar or restore, CPIO, amongst others. And there's also third-party commercial type backup software that you can get as well.
Just a quick point on backup here for those who might be interested in researching it further. There is actually a Linux book on backup posted by O'Reilly, and the only reason I mention it is because the free chapter that they give you to read on the O'Reilly website, because they always give you one chapter free of their book, is free backup utilities and how to use them, and it is a good chapter. The two backup utilities I've personally had stuff to do with is Mondo Rescue, and also Bless You Grace, and there goes another one. And the other one I've played with is a thing called Bacula, which is quite good. It apparently sucks the data out of your servers and backs it up onto tape. And there's a version for Windows, which might interest people. You can actually have a Bacula client that backs up all your Windows to the central server.
It's like Dracula, Bacula.
Does that mean to kill your server, you stick a stick through the power supply? Anyway.
That's it.
Okay, so Bacula, .sourceforge.net is worth a look. I'm just about to put my Epix back to sleep. It's woken up for some reason.
Okay, so you need to have also your networking utility on your emergency boot disk. Obviously you're going to need a network connection, and you'll need all the drivers for that. And another important thing is to mention is about when you're actually using a or booting a system with an emergency boot disk, it's the some recovery disks methods require you to have sort of unusual features to access the boot itself. For example, if you've got zip slack, and we go back to the zip drives, if you're using it, say, from a zip drive, or you're using it, whatever you're using, from a CD drive or a flash drive, and it's it needs to be booted from a kernel stored on a boot floppy. And that kernel would then, in that case, include support for your parallel zip drive, or if you're using a flash drive, would include support for that. Now, we talked about package dependencies in some of our previous chapters, so hopefully we understand a little bit about that. But when you install a package in a Linux system, you may need other packages in order for that package to work, so you need some compatibility. The dependency package, you might have to have a number of files that you need in place in order to run some of the services before your actual package can work.
Yeah, an example under Windows, has anybody ever noticed that you go to install the latest version of Screensaver Bling Bling Plus and it says this program requires .NET Framework 1.1? That's an example of a dependency.
Yeah, and you'll get notified when you're actually installing your package, you know, that it has dependencies, so you can actually install those, hopefully. when you're a system administrator, it's really important that you understand how to recognise different errors that you might encounter when you're installing programs or installing from an emergency boot disk. And there's a lot of reasons why you can get dependencies or conflicts when you're using Linux as well. And you know, most of them will notify you too if there's a dependency issue these days. Okay, you can also encounter problems with the missing libraries or the different support programs. And when we talk about libraries, we're talking about a support code, and that supports many of the different programs on your Linux system. And they use the libraries, just like we use a library, but they're part of the program itself. And if you, obviously, if you've got part of the library missing, the programs that you're wanting to install are obviously not going to work. So if you've got incompatible libraries, or you've got different support programs that are required, you would have to make sure that you've got the right version of the programs, and that the support is available within the library.
Now, I remember these notes going quite heavily into rerunning ldconfig and stuff along that, so when you get to this chapter, make sure you have a read through that, because it can sort of fix problems. But yes, version 1.6.1.4 is not the same as version 1.6.1.5, and there are some programs that want a specific version of a shared library. It's a bit like when you fire up a program under Windows and it goes vbr60c.dll is missing. It's a similar sort of error that you get under Linux.
I guess it's a good time to point out, too, just to remind everybody that we don't go into everything in the notes. During our lecture, we try and cover as much as we can, but what we think is relevant, but you do need to read your notes as well. End of announcement. Okay. Sometimes when using Linux, you'll have a number of packages that may require the use of the same files, and you know, when you're installing, and the files are features that are already installed on your system, and that can occasionally cause a program to malfunction. And the again, you'd be looking at the exact cause of your package dependency error, and you need to be reading what is in your error messages. That's the same in Windows. Something that somebody I know very well said to me when I was first learning about computers, read your error messages. Does that ring a bell, Kerry?
I'm salivating all over my headset here.
Yes.
Pavlov would be proud. I'll need more than a hanky. Yes, she used to come in and she'd go, I have a problem. And I'd go, well, what did the error message say? I don't know. Good, well, I'm not helping you. And I'd go off and have a coffee. So, yeah, you got to know what your error messages said. And after that, she always came in and said, well, it said blah. And then I go, well, I still don't know what's going on. I went and had a coffee. But at least I knew what the error message was.
Oh, I did try that. Oh, Kerry. Didn't work. Anyway. Okay, so make sure that you're reading your error message so that you can you know, find the solution to your package dependency problems or other errors that may be happening.
Step one, cut and paste the error message into Google. Step two, look at the results. Seriously, that is one surefire way of finding how to do something. If you have an error message, paste the pointy end bits into Google and see if somebody else has blogged about it or written about it and can tell you how to fix it.
Now, some of the other solutions, well, that's correct too. Google is your best friend. Yeah, and there's so much that's out there that you, if you Google up some of the information that we give you in lectures, pardon me, or from reading your notes, you will find a wealth of extra information available. Someone else has come across the same problem. Okay. Now, some other ways you can, you know, try and fix up dependency problems. You can do a number of things like forcing the installation, rebuilding the problem package from your source code or finding a different version of the problem package. When we talk about forcing it, there are instances when you can actually, you know, find that that's appropriate. So if you've got an error on the package and you've complied with the source code, then the installation can be forced. So in order to do that, you would use the NODEPS parameter, and that will force the installation over other errors such as conflicts that you might be having. And yes, can be done.
I think it's a case of if it breaks, you keep both pieces. That NODEPS will force it, but you should probably realise that if you are forcing it, then there might be a problem, and you should be aware of the consequences of forcing it.
Yes.
Because sometimes no really does mean no, and it's not going to install, and it's going to blow up horribly. So careful with NODEPS. It is not cool to get RPMs from a different version of Linux, jam them on top of your Red Hat system with --NODEPS, and pray to your deity of choice that the package is going to come up and work. It might not always be a happy situation, so just be aware of the risks you run, and make sure you've got backups before you do that, or that your machine doesn't matter.
You can also modify your system, and just for example, if you've got a package being installed and you need an updated library, then you can update your library, and hopefully that will solve the problem. You need to look at things like what packages you've got, what modifications you're making, document as you're doing things. Okay, so that's a really relevant thing, and make sure that if you don't know about documenting by now in IT2, you failed. So make sure that you're using whatever you're doing, whatever changes you're making, you document it so that you know what's been done, and if it's still broken, at least you know you've tried that solution. Sometimes you might actually need to rebuild your package from source code, and if you keep getting dependency error messages. And so some dependencies are the result, as I said, of libraries or support packages that you've got currently installed on your system. And sometimes you need to recompile what's there. So when you're recompiling the software, that's also going to cause dependencies for the various programs to change. So it's easier to rebuild your package using your source code, and that overcomes the changes, and it will hopefully modify your systems. And to do that, you would actually rebuild an RPM package, and you would use the rebuild command, and you know, you can sort of rebuild, say, from your source code, and instead of having to run one simple command, you would use a number of commands to configure your conformation that you're rebuilding. So there is a whole lot of notes on how to do that, which I'll refer you to your notes to there. Okay, because it's going to depend on what version of Linux you're running and all that sort of system.
Absolutely, and as an interesting case in point, we do occasionally build things from source. We were busy trying to build some bandwidth control modules on the Mac the other day, and we'll probably be building a new version of the LAME encoder for rapid encoding of lecture audio. So, yeah, there are times when you want to, and in fact, some packages such as LAME, which stands for LAME Ain't an MP3 Encoder, it's a recursive acronym, it's very funny, you actually only get source code, and you either have to build it from the source yourself or go scouring the net for the binaries, which of course are out there, but they are actually only licensed to distribute the source, so, something to be aware of.
One of the easy ways to fix any dependency problems, obviously, is to locate a different version of the package. If you've got problems with one, you can look for another option, a newer package, newer distribution that is hopefully going to overcome those dependency problems. Okay. One of the other types of errors that you may be able to, or you know, may come across, is backup and restore errors. So, as we've mentioned time and time again throughout the IT2 and IT1 course, is you need a reliable backup system. Just imagine if you're the administrator for a big business, and you know, you've got problems, and they say, well, what about the backup? And you haven't got them in place, you're going to be very, very unpopular. So, yeah, be aware of backing up and making sure that you've got all your data protected. And, you know, also some of these errors that you may come across, and you may need to restore your data to your Linux system as well. And so it's important to back up. And it's important to have that backup ready so that you can restore. Other problems, things like driver problems. Obviously, as it sounds, you know, you've got driver errors. You can access the internet to update your drivers, and that's an important thing to do as well. You might have file access errors. And you can get file access permissions, and you know, the type of errors that you know, that you would have is, you know, if it's showing up as a file error, you would be hopefully accessing your backups again and be able to back up most of your system files, and you can do a restore on those as well. The important point to note, there is only the root account will have file access rights on your Linux system. Okay, you can get media errors. Okay, so obviously we're talking about things like your CD, DVD, that type of thing, secondary hard drives. They can also be have problems. Not work and become damaged. So, and you know, these things are not lifelong guaranteed to work. People have a hard drive and they think that I've got a backup hard drive and it's never going to fail and I'm happy forever.
That's a good dream.
It is a good dream.
I've usually found, actually, that it's usually those sorts of people that have just copied all of their music collection onto their external hard drive and then brushed the external hard drive so that it falls off the desk and bounces, and they're quite distraught to realise that none of the data on that hard drive that fell off the desk is recoverable.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a good idea to have more than one type of backup. So if you've got... you know, disk failure, then you've got some other option available. You can also get files not found errors on Linux systems and on Windows systems. And when you, just for example, if on a Linux system, you know, you're wanting to back up your system, when you're restoring the data from backups, you'd be using the TAR CLI. And you may find that sometimes you'll be unable to restore a number of files. The reason for that is the TAR command line utility stores files without the leading --/, which means that when you're restoring files with TAR, the --/ shouldn't be included when you're restoring specific files and directories. Now there is a whole lot of stuff in your notes about that, so have a look through that, and because it's important to know how to actually do that manually. Okay, what else do we need to cover here? So okay, so the common backup errors, as in summary there, is your driver problems, looking for tape drive access errors, file access errors, media errors, and all those type of things, and files not found errors. just as a point of interest here, the among the organisation that developed the standards for computer networks, we have the IEEE. Anyone tell me what that stands for?
I can.
Yeah.
It's the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers.
That's the one. And it's also, it's been the active way of defining local area network standards. And through its 802 working groups, they started in about 1980, and they developed the IEEE and standards. And that's also the Ethernet standards, so the 802.3, the token ring 802.5, fiber optic networks 802.8, wireless local area networks, which is 802.11, and there are a number of others. And it's a well-known standard, and it gives you error control over your local area network types. And it's specific for logical link control, which is LLC 802.2. They are used in your local area networks, and they are all of your common devices, like your network interface cards, conform to that IEEE standards. Okay. So another problem you might encounter, getting back to problems, is loss of connectivity. Now, some of the troubleshooting that we can do is with, you know, looking at why we've lost connectivity, looking at physical connectivity first, look at your most obvious, and shush phone. And that would be your first, and then you would look at more detailed into your troubleshooting, and we would have a look at things like your TCP/IP settings and number of others. But first, check your physical link. A lot of times too, it's operator error. People can't get on the net because they've forgotten their password, or they've left their caps lock on. So some of your very obvious things in connectivity to look at those issues. Some of the other operator errors, you may find that the somebody's trying to get into the network, and they've been restricted because of the permissions on the network. There might be simple things, well, like hardware, they've, as I said, might be the physical connection that's down. A number of things that they could do. So when we're talking about TCP/IP, obviously at this stage of ITE2, you all know about TCP/IP and how to test for connectivity, but do you know so in Linux? That's the next question. So, you know, the most common TCP/IP tool that we use in Linux, Unix, and Windows systems is something called, and I'm waiting for it. Who can tell me? It's a command.
Oh, ping.
Thank you. Yes, the ping command. Okay. And and path ping. Anyone tell me what ping stands for? Need to know this.
Packet Internet Grouper.
That's right. Yep. Important you do know that one, guys, because you will get something on that in your exams. Okay. And what that Packet Internet Work Grouper or stands for, ping, it's a utility. It sends an echo request to your designated destination computer, and it uses ICMP to do that. Anyone tell me what ICMP stands for?
Internet Control Messaging Protocol.
Thank you, that's the one. Okay, and what happens then is that the destination computer, hopefully, if all's going well, sends an ICMP echo reply. So the first thing you would do if you've got a suspect connectivity problem, and it's not a physical problem, you know, everything's your Ethernet cable's plugged in, you would use the command ping to check your internet connection, and make sure that you can use it to a commonly used internet host. So if you get a reply and everything's hunky-dory, that's fine. But so basically, in order to do a test on TCP/IP, first step is to look at checking for a suspected connectivity problem by pinging the host, and that prints the name of the network server. If you've got a reply received, the physical connection between your two computers is intact. Now, something else you can do next is to use ipconfig, and that prints the current TCP/IP configuration, but that's in Windows. What do we use in Linux systems? ipconfig in Windows?
ifconfig?
That's the one, thank you. And yeah, important there to note that your IP address, subnet mask of your server, make a note of it for future reference. And also, if your IP address of the default gateway shows up as well, make a note of that also. Now, something else you can do is ping 127.0.0.1. Anyone tell me what that address is called or referred to? That's the one. Doing well, Grace. And the loopback address is used to see whether you've got TCP/IP installed correctly. So if you've got an error message there, you would need to remove and reinstall your TCP/IP protocol on your network server.
That's in the test.
It is. If you can also ping your own IP address, and what that does is it tests that your TCP/IP can communicate with the network adapter in the network server, and the IP address of the network server then displays in the output of the IF or ipconfig command, I should say.
I have a question.
Go.
What's the difference between pinging my IP address and the loopback address?
Pinging the loopback address doesn't rely on your network hardware to be functional. It only relies on the internal stack to be functional. Pinging your IP address on the network card assures that the network card has link, is connected to the hub, and that the transceiver on the network card is active.
Okay,
you could also ping the default gateway. And what that does is it tests that your network server can communicate from your network to another network that's another system on your network, for example, a router. And the IP address of your default gateway or the router then displays in the output of that ipconfig command. And you can also ping your remote host. And what I'm talking about there is the remote host being a computer on the other side of your default gateway or your router. And that what it does is it enables you to test that the router's all functioning well, and that it's forwarding the TCP/IP packet to the computer system on the other side of the router. You can also ping your own IP name, and what that does is it tests that your server can resolve its own IP name, or you can ping your remote host IP name. And what that will do is test that the DNS server is working and that it's resolving the host IP name of the remote computer. So very, very useful command is the ping command. And what we actually mean by that is the, I'll just reiterate, ping, if you use the ping command, it's testing your connectivity. You can use the ping time command, and it'll give you the amount of time that's actually elapsing between sending echo requests and by the time that it takes to receive your echo reply. And we use this all the time, don't we, Kerry?
We do.
If you've often possibly heard us saying, hey, ping time is such and such on Ventrilo when it's very high. So if you've got a high ping time. You've got a low speed connection. If you've got a fast, a low ping time means you've got a fast connection. And as I mentioned before, you can also test whether TCP/IP stack is installed correctly and functioning on your computer. And that's where you ping the 127.0.0.1 loopback address, and it's given the host name localhost in the etc. host file. And if you get a response, then all is hunky-dory and your stack is working. Now, a CLI version of ping is included with your TCP/IP stack of all of your Windows operating systems and also with your Unix and Linux distributions. In Windows 2000, just whipping back to Windows 2000, you've got path ping, and it's combines the features of ping with those of tracert and gives you additional information when you use that command. And when you're using, say, path ping, it's possible to detect which router is actually causing you problems on your network and to measure the number of packets that are being lost at a particular router. And now that brings me to the point of tracing your packet routes, and we actually use a tracing utilities to decide, to discover or highlight the route that's been taken by the packets to reach the destination. And the usual way we use that in Linux or Unix systems is the trace route command, as it sounds. And what that does is gives you all of the routers through the packet through which your packets are passing as they're traveling through the network and from the computer that sent them and onward to the destination computer. And why that command is useful is it can actually let you know which point in the network your packets are being lost or where they're being slowed down. So it's very, trace route is a very useful command to use.
Just a note that under Windows they spell it T-R-A-C-E-R-T, and under Linux we actually write
yes,
the whole
right.
word trace route.
Trace route. Yep. Okay, sometimes you'll find that connectivity problems on your network turn out to be configuration problems. For example, perhaps you've got an IP address assigned to your computer and it's not in the correct subnet range, or perhaps your subnet mask, your default gateway or your DNS address have been entered incorrectly. And if any of those entries are wrong, things won't work. Okay, so it won't communicate properly with the TCP network, TCP/IP network. So if you're using ifconfig /sbin ifconfig, it allows you to view or change the configuration of any of your network systems. And you can actually see what's going on. Also, the netstat utility can also troubleshoot network activity, and it tells you what connections have been made to and from the server, and that'll include things like your TCP connections, the ports on which the computer is listening, any of your Ethernet statistics, your TCP and UDP protocols, your IP routing table, all those type of thing. So it's a very useful command. And if you're wanting information on using that command, your man pages lists all your configuration parameters that you can use. Now, don't be frightened to use those man pages. There's a wealth of information there. So I would reiterate that if you're not sure, use them and look up what you need to do. Netconfig is another one, and it's in the USR SBIN netconfig, which allows you to either select the DHCP or IP configuration or to specify a static IP address. So also, as it sounds, you're configuring netconfig. So List open files, which is the LSOF utility, and it's not strictly a networking utility, but it helps you to identify networking related resources and processes that might be causing problems. So it gives you information about the files that are open and any running processes that are opening, and allows you to try and track down any problems. Okay, now, hang on, I'm just scrolling down. We're nearly at the end. So just a little summary here. When you're troubleshooting networks, you need good problem-solving skills. Don't forget, gather your information first. I know we've done this 100 million times, but I'll just reiterate again. Analyze your information. Think up a treatment plan, verify your results, and then document. I think that's clear enough.
I think so.
And that brings us to the end of today's lecture. Is there any questions that anyone has? Not really.
No.
Okay. Leon, you're all hunky-dory?
Oh, yes, Geraldine.
No worries. All right. Well, we can stop recording there.